KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a professor at Elon University School of Law and affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and this year a visiting research collaborator at the Center for Information Technology Policy at Princeton University. Today, as I promised on previous shows, I was going to do my best to use my opportunity here at Princeton to interview the many wonderful scholars and researchers that are at Princeton, and there's no better way for me to start that than to interview the head of the Center for Information Technology Policy, Professor Ed Felton. We are sitting in his office at Princeton University, and so you're hearing the mobile recorder that I used last week with Professor Squire to do the interview. We are going to discuss today a couple of topics. So there's a lot that we could talk about with Ed, but we're going to focus on two recent research interests among the many that Ed is known for. We're going to begin and do the first half of the discussion roughly on the amorphous question of virtual currencies, which are known now through its primary progenitor, Bitcoin. Bitcoin is supposed to be something substituting for traditional treasury-issued currencies. However, it operates in a virtual world. It can be used for commerce, but then sometimes it can't. It can be used to finance terrorism, although sometimes it isn't, and we don't quite know what to make of it. Ed's research, including a conference that occurred here at CITP a few weeks ago, focuses on what it is, what its stability is, what its ultimately capabilities are, and we're going to spend the first half of the discussion figuring out, or at least thinking about, what Bitcoin might be. Our second part of the discussion is going to be a focus on recent testimony that Ed gave before the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board on the topic, as he's called it, of defining privacy. What is privacy today in technology, which of course is a huge topic that's been a focus of many guests on Hearsay Culture, most recently chatting with Woody Hartzog and Ryan Kahlo with respect to privacy and robotics. But we've talked about this issue pretty much through the eight-year history of Hearsay Culture. Ed talks about how, and this was of course to policymakers, talks about how privacy can be thought of through three steps that he identifies as collecting data, merging data, and analyzing it. Some of the limitations that we have as human beings with regard to working through that data was a focus of his testimony, and we're going to dig into that as well as what privacy might mean today given security research and where we stand with the internet and the Internet of Things and where it has grown. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that over the 8-plus years of the show, I've tried to bring on a diverse range of guests. Ed is a perfect way to introduce my audience, not that many of you aren't already familiar with his work, to the Center for Information Technology Policy, and in that way not only enrich the show, but enrich our discussion. Ed's well known throughout the computer security research and information policy arenas, but for those that aren't familiar, he is focused on computer security and privacy, public policy issues relating to information technology. He founded the Center for Information Technology Policy in the mid-2000s, which is housed both at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton as well as the CS department. He blogs at a blog that is well known, Freedom to Tinker. On a personal level, I became familiar with Ed's work working on source code and voting machines in the mid-2000s and trade secrecy issues around it. And when I scratched my head and thought, my God, am I to understand that intellectual property law would prevent the public from understanding how a voting machine works? Perhaps I should learn more about this. That's when I came across Ed's work. So I'm thrilled to be here at the center this year as a visitor, and I'm thrilled to have Ed on the show today. We are recording on November 18th, 2014, for airing on November 20th. Ed, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Sure, I'm happy to be here.
Let's start off with, again, many of my listeners, perhaps most, are familiar with you, but for those that aren't familiar with your work and perhaps CITP, talk a bit about your background, CITP, and how you got into security research broadly defined.
Sure. Well, I'm a computer scientist by training, and I've been here at Princeton as a faculty member for about 20 years. And when I first came here, I was doing just sort of straight-ahead computer science. But as I got more interested in security and privacy issues, I started to realize that that overlapped with public policy. And I started to do more and more work that crossed the boundary between computer science and public policy. And eventually I got cross-appointed as a professor in the Woodrow Wilson School, which is our public policy school. and then convinced the university to set up a center, CITP, which is kind of at the boundary between computer science and public policy. And when we first started doing this, maybe 10 years ago, people would always ask, what in the world does computer science have to do with public policy? But these days, they don't ask that anymore, because it's becoming more and more obvious that because technology is intertwined into so many different things that people do, that that it's touching public policy issues a lot. And I'm sure that listeners to this show don't need to be convinced of that.
Right. Is the in the almost 10-year, I guess, history of CATP, what have you found, before we get into Bitcoins, what have you found is perhaps from your experience has been the biggest change in policymakers' understanding of technology from 2005 to 2014?
Well, I think the biggest thing is mostly recognizing that the importance that technology has, and policymakers realizing that they could use technical mechanisms and regulation of technology as a lever to move the policy world in the direction they want. I think that many policymakers also have really awakened to the need to get more technical expertise and to interact more with the technical community, although it's often a struggle to get those two communities to talk to each other in a productive way.
I'll ask it now, though we can get to it later, but I think it's a good time. One of the challenges that I've noticed in the policymaking world, and this is something that came out with the Stop Online Piracy Act and others, is the challenge of scientists and technologists and engineers talking the language of policymakers. Mm-hmm. And I know that that's something that you focus on and that the center focuses on. Have you seen improvement or change in that when you have security researchers here at CIT? Or when you talk to them, do you get a sense that they understand the need to have that conversation, and what do you find on the other side?
Yeah. Well, certainly people on both sides of that divide understand the need to have the conversation, but wanting to do it and knowing how to do it are different things.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things we've really focused on. I mean, I focused on that personally, working with policymakers over the years, and I spent almost 2 years actually working in the government at the Federal Trade Commission as one way to learn more about this. But one of the things we really focus on is trying to have those conversations on campus, and a different thing, which is making sure that people understand how to talk to policymakers, how to participate in the policy debate in a way that's going to be effective.
Before we turn to Bitcoin, a bit more on CITP, perhaps you discuss a little bit more of the structure of CITP and how, from a subject matter perspective, how it's arranged.
Sure. We're really supposed to be bridging between engineering and computer science on one side and the social sciences and public policy on the other. And so a lot of that is just about doing things, having events and seminar series and bringing visitors to campus like yourself to try to get people in the same room and talking so that the folks know each other. A certain amount of what we do is really matchmaking. Helping people who are in one part of the university find someone in another who's interested, helping people discover connections. Helping the computer scientists who work on things like Bitcoin talk to the finance people who work on things like Bitcoin and so on. So we really focus a lot on that. We also focus on education at the undergraduate level. We help administer a certificate program, which is the Princeton equivalent of a minor. And we have a field trip every fall where we take a bunch of undergraduates down to Washington and we make the rounds of different policymaking offices and agencies.
And that's something through the what I understand to be the policy task force courses. Is that part of that structure?
Wilson School, the Woodrow Wilson School, has as part of its program for its majors what they call policy task forces. And that is, it's a one-semester course where a group of students get together and they work on some specific policy issue for a specific client. It kind of simulates the kind of expert panel that government agencies sometimes put together to write a report, but it's sort of a combination of that with students writing big semester-long papers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, you know, that starting a conversation and bringing disparate disciplines together was, in fact, the founding reason for Hearsay Culture, and attempting to do the same thing at Stanford, which I also found, right, like Princeton, sometimes it's hard for people to know what other people are doing given how busy everyone is and the communication that exists inside institutions.
Right.
So it's a wonderful goal. Well, let's turn, and we're chatting with Professor Ed Felton of the Center for Information Technology Policy at Princeton University. Let's turn to Bitcoins. And, you know, if I was doing this as a typical radio interview, I'd say, tell me what those are. Let me ask the question in a little bit more detail. We've had this idea, and I've heard it described as a cryptocurrency.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's probably a good way to start a discussion of what Bitcoin is by asking you to define, A, whether you think that that's a good name for what Bitcoins are, but if you do, or if you have another name, what does cryptocurrency mean?
Yeah, well, cryptocurrency is as good a word as any to describe things like Bitcoin. But the basic idea is that it's a form of currency. You can imagine that there are coins, but you transfer coins not by handing over some piece of metal, and not by interacting with some institution like a bank, but by through cryptography. So, for example, you might have a secret cryptographic key that only you know. And in Bitcoin, a coin is not, strictly speaking, not owned by a person. It's controlled by a key.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can use your key to put what's called a digital signature on a certain transaction. And so if a transaction is spending or transferring coins that belong to your key, then your key has to digitally sign that transaction to make sure that it's okay. And so it's that use of cryptography and that makes it a cryptocurrency. And what can be beneficial about that is that anybody, any computer, can look at that digital signature and make sure that it's valid. And so a transaction in a system like Bitcoin is kind of self-confirming in the sense that any computer can look at it and know for sure whether it's valid or not. Unlike in real currency, you have issues with counterfeiting. If you're doing a transfer through an institution or a credit card or something, you're always worried, is this card bogus? Is the transaction going to get reversed and so on? So there's a certain level of certainty that comes from doing it with cryptography. And also it can happen very quickly because it can all be automated.
Mm.
There are some downsides too, though. If a transaction happens, there's no undoing it. If your private key gets lost, your money's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Totally gone. It's gone forever. There's no getting it back. If your secret key gets stolen, then whoever stole it can transfer the money to whoever they want, probably themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no appeal from that. So it's a different kind of form of money, which has its pros and cons.
And it's also not backed by governments, correct?
I mean, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's not really backed by anything.
And that was going to be my question.
Sure.
Yeah,
there's no institution or anything standing behind it, and that might freak you out, right? That it's backed. It's purely digital. It's backed by nothing. But the way that economists think about money in the modern world is a little bit counterintuitive sometimes, right? So a dollar, for example, is not quite backed by anything except this notion of the full faith and credit of the U.S. government, whatever that means, right? That's just words on paper,
right?
In a sense. So, you know, a form of money has value because there's demand for it, if there is,
mm-hmm.
right? And like anything else, the price of bitcoins is driven by supply and demand. There's a fixed supply of bitcoins, so as long as there's demand for them, then it will have a price. And in fact, you can trade bitcoins for dollars. There are markets that are kind of like foreign exchange markets that where you can, and you know, there's a well-published price every day that goes up and down according to the fluctuations of that market.
The Bitcoin itself is, I don't want to say, is a branded version of a cryptocurrency, correct?
Well,
how would you describe Bitcoin's relation to this domain?
Yeah, well, there's this general concept of cryptocurrencies that refers to any kind of a form of value which is transferred by cryptography, right? And Bitcoin is a specific design. And Bitcoin also, you can think of it as there's a certain set of coins that exist in the Bitcoin system. There are also a lot of different kinds of cryptocurrencies. Some of them are basically clones of of Bitcoin. So if you wanted to set up Hearsay Culture Coin, you could do that. You could just take the Bitcoin software, which is open source. You could just make a copy of it. And all you'd have to do is sort of change one thing, which is the sort of initial allocation of coins, make that be different. And now you have your own cryptocurrency. So what makes Bitcoin the one that everyone pays attention to is that that's the one that people want. And it's, you know, it's a thing about money that the money, it has value because other people will accept it. And so there's a kind of network effect that exists, right? So there are lots of other cryptocurrencies, but Bitcoin is by far the biggest.
And so who or what accepts a Bitcoin? What can I do with it as a consumer?
Sure. Well, you can transfer it to anybody else who is in the Bitcoin system. And the question is, who else is in the Bitcoin system that you might want to transfer to? And there are some merchants who will accept it, like Overstock.com and... there's some online sites like WordPress. You can pay your monthly bill. If you have a WordPress blog, you can pay with Bitcoins. And there's a bunch of there's a growing number of merchants who will take Bitcoins. We're starting to see now sort of point of sale terminals that a merchant can get. And in certain cities, in certain neighborhoods, you will sometimes see point of sale terminals, where someone who has a Bitcoin wallet software on their phone can hold their phone up next to the point of sale terminal, and a bunch of things happen, mm-hmm. and then Bitcoins are transferred.
And so, if I want to, I want to get into the research, but to set the stage, right? So, if I want to acquire my first Bitcoin, how do I do that?
Well, you need to find someone who has Bitcoins and are willing to exchange those for dollars, or just make you a gift. Mm-hmm. The way I got my first Bitcoin is I bought it from one of my graduate students who had them. I gave him some good old-fashioned dollars, and he gave me some Bitcoins. But there are services that you can go to where you can set up an account. You can link it to your bank account or credit card. And then it's just a matter of going to a website and filling out a little form and, you know, clicking the box. And you transfer dollars to this company, and they transfer Bitcoins into your account.
Is there a way to assess how much cryptocurrency or Bitcoins are out there at a given moment? What do you know about those numbers, and how would you assess them?
Well, we know the number of Bitcoins in existence. It's 12 point some million. I forget exactly what the number is. It goes up very slowly. Mm-hmm. So you know exactly how many Bitcoins there are. And one of the interesting things about Bitcoin is that there is a public log that records every transaction. Mm. Every single transaction that has ever happened in the Bitcoin system is in this log. In fact, it's kind of the rules that if something isn't in the log, then it didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And so you can know exactly how many Bitcoins there are in existence. That's well known. There are websites you can go to online, and you can see all of these transactions. You can click around, and you can get a ticker of them and see how many Bitcoins are being transferred. So there's a lot of transparency about the transactions. What there isn't so much transparency about is who the people are. Because remember, as I said before, the coins are really controlled by secret keys rather than directly by people. Mm-hmm. And so you can see that a particular key acquired a certain number of Bitcoins from a particular other key at some time. But you'll have to, it's up to you to try to figure out what that was for.
Well, and that gets to my last beginning question before we get into the work that you and your colleagues are doing here, right? So governments have not been too thrilled about, from what I can tell, mm-hmm. about the existence of Bitcoins. What's been generally the governmental, you know, treasury reaction to these currencies?
Well, let's see. The U.S. government has mostly taken a wait and see approach to Bitcoin. They have made clear that financial reporting and money laundering rules still apply in the Bitcoin world. If you're trading Bitcoins for suitcases full of cash and not reporting anything, you're going to have a visit from the feds pretty quickly.
Uh-huh. And they're able to do that because they can go to the logs. Is that fair?
Well, what they would see in that case was a transfer of some number of Bitcoins, mm-hmm. But they would probably be following the dollars. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so there's still obligations to report, know your customer and all that. If you're trading Bitcoins for dollars, mm-hmm. The government has said that for tax purposes, Bitcoins are property rather than currency, which means that if you buy Bitcoins at, you know, X dollars and you sell them at X plus $2, that's an investment gain that you have to report, and so on. So they've mostly watched and allowed things to happen. They have taken action when there's something that looks like fraud or cheating. Now, there is one exception in the U.S., one place where government has been more, is thinking about being more aggressive, and that's the New York Department of Financial Services, which is the state of New York's regulator of the financial industry, has proposed something they call a bit license, which certain kinds of Bitcoin-related companies would be required to have. They put that out for comment, and there's been a lot of comments, and NYDFS is now thinking about revising that proposal. We don't know where that's going to end up, but they've at least proposed heavier regulation of Bitcoin businesses that look like banks or money transfer services or things like that.
So let's turn to the work that you're doing. And so from a security standpoint, right, you mentioned mm-hmm. some of these downsides. You know, as we turn to the research that you and, you know, Arvind Narayanan and others are doing here, what is your – let's start there.
Sure.
What is the concern and what is our capability to deal with that issue?
Sure. Well, there's a bunch of issues we're looking at in the research. One of them goes to how people can more securely manage – their Bitcoins. So your coins are protected by a secret key, and so you better protect that secret key. On the one hand, you need to keep it secret because it controls your money. On the other hand, you want to be able to use it so that you can do transactions. There's a kind of security tug of war. So the question is, are there ways of structuring systems? Are there ways of managing your keys and so on, so that the risk of a theft or a loss is lower, but you still have the convenience of being able to spend and transfer your money when you want? So that's problem number one, is how to securely manage Bitcoins. And that's especially an issue for businesses that are handling, that have a big flow of coins in and out. Mm-hmm. Given that transactions are irreversible, given that there's some degree of anonymity in transactions, if you're a company that has thousands and thousands of Bitcoins flowing in and out all the time, you better worry about employee fraud,
right,
for example. So what can you do to protect against that? That's number one. Number two question goes to the security and stability of the whole Bitcoin ecosystem. Bitcoin, I talked before about the Bitcoin log, which records all of the transactions. The method by which Bitcoin builds the log is really interesting. There's no central entity in charge. There's this sort of worldwide cooperative effort that is supposed to cause everyone to agree on what's actually in the log and what's not. And there's a lot of open questions about how stable that so-called mining process is. And so we're looking at that basic stability question of, is the system stable? Can it be undermined? Can it be manipulated? That's number two. And number three, we're looking at questions about what kinds of functionality can be built using Bitcoin. That is, can you make more advanced kinds of financial capabilities, facilities, and make them be self-enforcing in the same way that the rules of Bitcoin are self-enforcing, through cryptography using the actual Bitcoin system? Those are sort of the three big questions.
And when we so these questions, it seems all of them have a heavy, potentially regulatory aspect. Or in other words, there is some degree of self-regulation that could occur here within the market. But it seems like at some point in all of these situations, one who has, as you mentioned, right, a concern about Bitcoins disappearing or about a mm-hmm. security issue would want to be able to deal with that issue in a way not perhaps just to allow recovery, but to allow for cryptocurrencies or Bitcoins to have more stability generally, and therefore
sure.
more recognition and more buy-in mm-hmm. and more people willing to use it. What is, from a policy standpoint, what is it that you see that governments could do, if they wanted to, mm-hmm. to deal with this problem, or these problems,
sure.
really?
Well, one thing government can do is play the traditional role of law enforcement role with respect to fraud and dishonest business practices. There's been a fair amount of shenanigans in the Bitcoin sector, and sort of as you'd expect when you have a very fast moving, very new, very international, very complex sector where there are billions of dollars of value sloshing around. So there's been a certain amount of bad behavior.
Can you give a couple of examples of what's gone on here?
Well, so one of the big problem areas has been what are called Bitcoin exchanges. And you can think of them as being in some ways similar to a bank. They will hold your Bitcoins for you. They'll facilitate trades of dollars versus Bitcoins. They will ship Bitcoins out to some merchant or someone when you tell them to. More or less half of the Bitcoin exchanges that have ever existed have failed. Some of them because the people running the exchanges just absconded with the money. Some of them because they had some kind of a computer intrusion that where someone was able to extract the money. Some of them we still don't know what exactly happened. Some of them look like they may have been Ponzi schemes. But anyway, that's a lot of failures, and certainly some of it, at least, is due to either outright fraud or people being very careless with other people's money. And so one of the areas that where there's often a call for regulation is trying to establish more sanity here, or at least to asking government to create a greater disincentive to people just stealing in this space. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the areas. There's also the question I talked about the overall stability of the Bitcoin protocol, the Bitcoin mining system, whether that could be manipulated to the extent it might be possible technically for someone to manipulate the Bitcoin system. One would probably like government to try to deter that manipulation, to have that. Some of the sorts of manipulation of Bitcoin that might be possible look like possibly antitrust violations. Mm-hmm. They involve collusion among parties to try to rig the market and so on. And so you could imagine that government enforcement of those sorts of laws would also be possibly helpful.
As you describe these issues, it occurs to me that it seems, and tell me if I'm wrong, that these two issues you describe with Bitcoins are kind of a culmination of the work you did with regard to Microsoft, right? And even the source code issues and voting machines that to which I referred, right? This overlap of market control, right? Control mm-hmm. of information yeah. and government's willingness or lack thereof to address those issues. Are there corollaries between your previous work, and I know the voting machine sure. issue continues, but your previous work with the Microsoft antitrust case, which for those who aren't familiar, involved the bundling of Microsoft software and the inability of consumers to decouple this software, so they had to buy five products in when they wanted one, and the voting machine issue involving the ability to assess code. Corollaries?
Well, I think so. At a high level, it has to do with the question of whether government should be stepping in to make sure that the market can operate in an effective way. In the case of Bitcoin, if Bitcoin is playing an increasing role in certain areas of the economy, it makes sense, I think, for government to try to foster the stability of that sector and transparency so that consumers can have a better idea of what they're getting into when they're involved there. To a certain extent, the market is able to provide improvements in security and privacy for consumers if they can get the information they need and if they have real choices to make.
So what is the status of the research that you're doing here? What kind of work specifically are you doing to get at these problems?
Sure. Well, it's different in each case. In the case of how to manage Bitcoins, we have work going on that involves devising new kinds of cryptographic methods that let people have it's kind of like the equivalent of how when you're logging into a website, some sites have two-factor authentication or two-factor login, so it's not just your password, but also there's something else, there's something on your phone, or they send you a text message or something. So there are two different paths that both need to be checked. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that you want to do in helping people control their money is to have sort of different methods of controlling the keys which backstop each other. There's different methods that are known for keeping some of your money kind of in a vault and a little bit of it in your pocket,
right,
if you will, and how to transfer that back and forth. So at a conceptual level, it's not rocket science, but how to actually translate it into cryptography and software is the challenge.
So let me ask this last question before we take a quick break. And again, we're chatting with Professor Ed Felton of Princeton's Center for Information Technology Policy on KZSU-FM, Stanford, and Hearsay Culture. These projects take time, but is there a window in which you're working to be able to get to the point where you can say, we think we might have a solution to, or is it an open-ended process where when you hit it, you hit it?
Well, some of these things are really open-ended. The questions about the stability and manipulability of the overall Bitcoin protocol, I think it's going to take years to work that out. My students and I have been working on that particular issue for almost 2 years now, and the whole research community know just a little bit about it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to take a long time, but it's a really important question. There are already many billions of dollars in the Bitcoin economy. So the question of whether somebody can knock that over tomorrow seems like it's worth spending some time on.
And this is and that is the segue into our discussion about the privacy concerns, and particularly our ability to understand exactly what it is that we're doing. So we're going to talk about that in a second. You're listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU-FM Stanford. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University. It requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU. I don't think KZSU accepts Bitcoins, but I could look into it. But the traditional model, the 20th century model, is to go to our website and click on Donate to KZSU, or you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Regardless, please continue to listen to the show and to KZSU. So Ed, I was mentioning this overlap, which I think is there. You tell us a little bit overview about this testimony that you gave really a few days ago, and again we're recording on November 18th, involving privacy and a PCLOB. And again, I'll ask you this basic question: what is the PCLOB for those that aren't familiar, and why were you there?
Sure. This board was set up ultimately, as a result of the 9/11 Commission report. One of the things that, so after the 9/11 attacks, the president appointed this high-level commission to look at everything that had happened and whether government had made mistakes, what changes should be made, and so on. And they recommended a bunch of things. They recommended that parts of the government be more aggressive about collecting and using information, but they recommended at the same time that there was a need for increased oversight over the intelligence and law enforcement agencies that were going to be doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And so they recommended the creation of this new organization, which ultimately Congress enacted, and the president then appointed five people to serve on it. So the job of this board is to look at the practices of intelligence and law enforcement agencies with respect to privacy and civil liberties. It's right there in the name of the board. They have the power to ask for demand information and answers from these agencies, and they issue reports and so on.
And so your talk there was really testimony. This was in the context of a hearing? And so what was the focus of the hearing? I mean, obviously, broadly construed, it is privacy and civil liberties, but why did they were they having a hearing last week?
The hearing was called, the title of the hearing was Defining Privacy, and the idea was that they wanted to get a better picture of how people think about privacy. And so they asked me to come and talk about how computer scientists think about privacy. They had some social scientists, they had some lawyers, and they had some people from government agencies about how they think about privacy and civil liberties and so on. The idea was to get a more precise picture. As you know, if you follow privacy much at all, you know that the question of what counts as a privacy harm and what doesn't can be contested. And there's different definitions, and it's easy to get into a long, long argument about what is privacy anyway.
Right.
And you don't want to spend too much time arguing about it, because I think people have an intuitive idea of what it is that's at stake when privacy is at stake. But nonetheless, I think they wanted to get some ideas about what was going on. They asked me to come in as a computer scientist who studies this stuff.
And that's what I was going to ask you about. I'm an attorney. I focus on technology law, intellectual property law, and here I am sitting right in a CS building, computer science building at Princeton. And the panel itself is made up of whom, and which gets to the question I have, which is a computer scientist talking about these issues that sound heavily regulatory. Mm-hmm. How do you apropos of our earlier discussion, how do you translate personally, right, the technical knowledge that you have about computing to a board made up of policymakers, most if not all of whom are not computer scientists?
They're all lawyers.
Right.
So that's part of the challenge. I'm asked to summarize a broad area of knowledge in orally to non-experts in 7 minutes. Mm-hmm. But that focuses the mind.
Yeah.
And so what I really tried to do is to give a basic framework of how computer scientists tend to think about privacy. Mm-hmm. And I talked about this three-stage pipeline. One of the things I wanted to do is to help people understand what has changed in the way that we think about privacy since, say, the 1970s, when a lot of the intellectual framework behind today's public policy around privacy was laid down. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of the first 40% of what I said. And the last 60% is what are implications of the trends in privacy for policymaking and for the work of the board.
So you mentioned as you framed your testimony, and I mentioned in the introduction, you talk about this three-stage pipeline. What is that, and how is that, or why is that helpful for policymakers?
So the three-stage pipeline, the idea is, well, there are three stages. The first stage is to collect information, and that's both information that a person discloses to someone, but also information that's observed from a camera or some kind of a sensor or web tracking technologies or something, information about people's behavior. And that information often comes in sort of little tiny atoms of information. Mm-hmm. That someone looked at a particular web page at a particular time, and there's some, let's say, unique identifier that is associated with that. So this information is first collected, then it's merged. So whenever two files of information, of data, can be determined to relate to the same person, then those two files can be merged. Mm-hmm. So, and that merging can set up a kind of avalanche effect, because when you take two files and merge them, the result is more detailed, more specific, and maybe that helps you to recognize that, oh, this is the same person who we have another file about over there. Mm-hmm. And so there's this stage of merging all of these disparate, separately collected records into a large data set. That's phase two of the pipeline. And the last stage of the pipeline is analyzing all of that data by using machine learning and sort of advanced analytic methods to try to make inferences about people and what they're doing.
So let me dig right in, and we have about 15 minutes or so left. I'm starting to get close to what I call the unfair portion of the show, and particularly for you, this is going to be very unfair because I ask questions that you can't possibly answer to your satisfaction in the time that you have, although you are a professional from what you just told me and based on your experience of doing that. So let me dig in anyway. Still have 15 minutes, which is a luxury. Let me jump right to this question that I referred to before because I think it's so critical to our understanding of this problem, right? You talk about in your formal testimony that the consequences of collecting a data item can be difficult to predict. So frame that for my listeners, if you will. When a piece of data is collected, what generally is the framework through which that decision to collect that data is made, and how does the predictability then become a problem?
Right. So the problem is that at the moment data is being collected or a person's being asked to disclose a piece of data, it's really hard to think about how that might be used. Why? Because the last two stages of that pipeline I talked about are difficult to predict. So this data item that you're being asked to provide, say, may look pretty harmless, but it may end up getting merged with a lot of other data. You know, it's hard to tell what it will be merged with, what it's linkable to, but it might end up getting connected, or might not end up getting connected to some big record about you, and that record may form a kind of mosaic. People talk about the mosaic effect in the same way that a mosaic is made up of these little sort of stones or pieces of glass, which don't look like much individually. You put them all together, you get a really nice picture. Mm-hmm. In the same way, little items of data put together can give you a pretty complete picture of somebody's life. So it's hard to predict how they'll be merged, and then it's hard to predict what kind of analysis will come out of them. So one of my favorite examples here goes to this pretty well-known case where Target, the retailer, was able to build a machine learning model that inferred which of their female customers were likely pregnant. Mm-hmm. And it was a fairly accurate model, but it was based on seemingly harmless-looking purchase data. So, for example, when a woman becomes pregnant, she might switch from scented hand lotion to unscented because she doesn't want to put she wants to avoid putting chemicals on her body. So that switch, a person who has bought scented to unscented, seems like a pretty harmless individual piece of data. One purchase of unscented hand lotion on one day, but that's a clue. It gets linked to the record. It goes into an inference, and probably, if you had stopped one of those women at the checkout stand and said, "Are you worried about disclosing to Target that you bought that you're buying that product today?" They probably would have said, "What's the harm?" But then Target ends up. Maybe that was the key thing that enabled the inference that that she was likely pregnant. And so it's that kind of effect that you get. You can get a fairly sensitive inference out the back end of this pipeline, even if you put one more fairly harmless-looking piece of data in the front end. And that makes it really hard to reason about what the consequences of disclosing data, as well as for an organization like an intelligence agency or even a retailer that wants to think about what is the risk of inadvertent or use or breach of a particular piece of data. You have to think about what might happen to it downstream.
There was a lot of, as I know you know, and in fact we discussed on Hearsay Culture, there was a lot of discussion this past summer about Facebook's study, right, of data yes. that they had, right, and wall manipulation, right, manipulating mm-hmm. data that was being delivered to Facebook customers for purposes of an academic study, right, to indicate whether, apparently to study whether people would have emotional reactions, positive or negative, to the data. James Grimmelman was on the show this summer talking about that work. James's view, with summarizing it, although not doing it justice, is that this was a failure on a number of levels, including notice, mm-hmm. Which I want to ask you about here. How much of the privacy issue from the consumer side, obviously, as you mentioned, there are multiple harms that we could talk about, but taking this narrow question of privacy interests of the data creators, if you will, right, the providers, how much of this, in your view, is an issue of adequate notice to consumers? In other words, to the extent that we had data analysts who were able to say, this is the data that we have and that we're collecting, and here is what we think we can do with it. Would that satiate the concerns that you believe the public and that policymakers should be dealing with?
Well, certainly notice is a key question. And there are really two questions you could ask about notice, right? One is, does the end user know that this data is being collected at all? Because a lot of data that's collected, the end user doesn't really know that it's collected. Sometimes there really is no notice. Sometimes there is a kind of legal fiction of notice that if the consumer had gone to hunting, they might have been able to find a privacy policy that maybe said something vague about this. But it might be a fact that the person doesn't know that information is collected and is assuming that it's not. And this becomes this question of whether they even know is a bigger issue with respect to data that's collected by observation of a person's behavior, because it's not easy to provide notice in some cases. So, for example, there are technologies now in retail stores that can uniquely recognize your particular mobile phone because of the radio signals that it sends out, mm-hmm. and can figure out that a particular that you as an individual walked into the store at some point and sort of what path you took through the store and so on. It's hard to figure out how to provide notice of that kind of sensor because unlike something like Facebook where you're interacting with it deliberately, if they're just kind of passively observing you, it's hard to figure out even how to do notice. So the first part of notice is, do you even know, does the consumer even know that this is being collected? And then the second part of notice is, do they understand the implication, how it's going to be used and what the implications are? And that's also very difficult, even for a well-intentioned data collector to support, because they may not know themselves what the implications will turn out to be.
Are there any high-profile, or not even high-profile, but examples of data being collected where programmers themselves ultimately didn't understand what they were collecting that would be an example of this problem? Anything that we know about or anything that has not been discussed in great detail?
Well, I mean, it happens a lot. Often the mindset in developing a technology or a system mm-hmm. is let's collect this in the hopes that it might be useful. Mm-hmm. And when you're in that mindset, then most of the time you don't know how data is going to be collected. Probably when Target was collecting the purchase data, at the time they collected most of the data they used in their pregnancy study, they didn't know that it might be used for that purpose later on. There was just sort of a general desire to use it to figure out more things about consumers so that they could sell to them more effectively.
We have a notion, I think, and it comes, I think, in part from the founding of the internet, that when coders and programmers build a system, they embed values into it,
yes.
right? And that's some that you know that end-to-end concept on the internet, right? And packet switching and all of this, you know, as Tim Wu now calls net neutrality, principles and ideas seem to be built in. Is that a correct understanding of what coding was happening, not just then, but more importantly today? Because I almost hear you saying that coders have become really functionaries of larger entities that want data, as opposed to having a value structure that they, through their coding, can bake into a program or a piece of software. What's your take on that, if the question was intelligible?
Yeah, no, yeah. I think so. Well, certainly there's, I think, a conventional wisdom that data about people is valuable generally, and that there are a lot of business models that are built around the collection and analysis use of data. And if that's the mindset you're in, if you're trying to build a successful business, whether you are a rank and file coder in a big company, or whether you're, you know, the CEO of a startup who's also an engineer, mm-hmm. You may be in the mindset that you want to get data, and that it's okay to collect a lot of data because we're good people and we're not going to use it for any evil purpose. And there may be consequences down the road to which you didn't foresee, and that maybe you wish didn't happen, but nonetheless. I think there is a mindset that data is valuable, and certainly you need to draw a line, I think, between people who are coding, who are building systems because they have idealistic purpose, versus people who are in business. And because there are a lot of coders who, have a business mindset. That's really sort of the Silicon Valley ethos, is to be an engineer and be a business person at the same time. Mm-hmm. And to the extent it's conventional wisdom that data is valuable, then a person in that mindset is going to be collecting data.
Should we be thinking about the complexity of these issues from the standpoint of governmental regulation? Or is there a better way for us to frame these issues that perhaps take the onus off of government or allow us at least to change the prism through which we think about addressing these harms?
Yeah. Well, I think, an ideal outcome would be one where a consumer, a user who is doing something in the market has a good idea of the privacy implications of the things they're doing, good idea of the privacy implications of buying from vendor A versus vendor B, and then they can make the decision based on what they value. Mm-hmm. The problem is that's not really the world we live in, that there is... not much information available to people about what's really going on. there are not many control levers that they can pull or push to make things change. And there was just a big poll by the Pew Research Center about people's attitudes toward privacy. And one of the big things that emerged from it is that most people feel like they don't really have effective control over any of this stuff, that no matter what they do, their data is going to end up in big databases. And so there's people just, if that's the mindset you're in, then you're going to use whatever's most convenient. People feel like, I think a lot of people feel like they've lost control. So that's a scenario where that market is not really working. The hard part is understanding, you know, what is it that policymakers or standards bodies or anybody else can do to provide effective transparency? And that's one of the things that we in the research community often try to do, right? There's certainly a lot of non-transparency, but to the extent that we can do measurement studies, we can talk publicly about some of the things, practices that are going on so that people know, we can provide a little bit more transparency. But absent that transparency, it's pretty tough to figure out what to do. But at the same time, we're not quite sure how to get more transparency than we currently have.
Yes, which of course opens up a second hour of Hearsay Culture if we went in that direction now, because that's a huge topic. Let me, and one that I'm personally interested in as well. Let me ask you this last question, Ed, as we are well into the unfair portion of the show. So much of what CITP does and what you have done is attempting to bring technical expertise into government. And you just alluded to it, right? Transparency is one major institutional roadblock to getting expertise to the right places. Now, it's a personal interest of mine. It's something I focus on. But I want to ask this question from your perspective. How can we build out technological expertise in government? Other than the question of transparency, what do you see as the major roadblocks, and can we get there? And I don't mean that from a crystal ball perspective. I mean it from an institutional one.
Sure. Well, there are, I think, a couple things. One is to try to raise the level of technical understanding of the media and government employee or the media and policymaker or staffer. Right, and that's really a broad educational effort. We're working pretty hard here at Princeton, and I think a lot of good universities are working to bring better education about computing to the broad range of students, not just the engineers and scientists and mathematicians. Our goal is to teach every student here a good at least one serious computer science course. We're at about 75%, which is pretty good. So that's partly generational. It's partly educational thing, right? That the younger staffers are generally better than the older ones on this. The other question is how we can get people who are more serious career experts in computing, in computer science, to spend some time in government and to make a career path within government or within the public sector be viable for people like that. And that's partly cultural. There are other disciplines that have done a better job than us. Government certainly has no shortage of lawyers. Mm-hmm. But economists and physicists, for example, have been relatively successful at building links to government, creating places within government and career paths so that people can go back and forth between outside positions, or you can really build a career inside government. And we as computer scientists have to figure out a way to do that as well.
Professor Ed Felton, Kahn Professor of Computer Science and Public Affairs at Princeton and founder and head of the Center for Information Technology Policy. Thank you so much for joining us today on the show. I mean, this is obviously, I'm looking forward to spending more and more time here over the course of the year and coming years, but I welcome you back on the show to continue this discussion. I look forward to the eventual ultimate solution of the Bitcoin problem as well as solving the informational problems in government if you can, achieve those. But seriously, thank you so much for being on the show and educating my listeners.
Thanks. It's been fun.
We have some great guests coming up on the show for the remaining days in the quarter. Stephen Turner from the University of Southern Florida on his work on expertise in government, speaking of this issue. Gabby Coleman, who's going to be on discussing her new book, Anonymous, studying the anonymous group of leakers and hackers. Also, Professor Danielle Citron from the University of Maryland on hate crime on the Internet. Lorelei Eli Kelly from the New America Foundation, also on resilience and expertise in government, and Nabiha Syed, who's going to be focusing on First Amendment issues and technology, and many others coming up, not just in the remaining fall quarter, but also the winter quarter on Hearsay Culture. As always, you have a couple of ways to listen to the show. You can listen this quarter, 10 a.m. Pacific time, by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu. That's 10 a.m. a.m. Pacific time on Thursdays, where this show and others will be airing. You can also get the show by going to hearsayculture.com, which is being rebuilt through the efforts by my friend Oliver Day, dealing with the hackers that we've had attacking the show, as well as going to the iTunes page for the Center for Internet Society, or going to the webpage for CIS at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. So thank you much for joining me on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.